Today's Story Archaeology's Stories in the Landscape conversation is with Sana Malik. So today I get to talk with Sana Malik. I met Sana after we got talking online about Ralph Kenner's Legacy to Story Archaeology, the paper, The Extraordinary Story of Shinnan. However, we soon found out that we had a lot more conversations to share. So here we are. But Sana, that's enough from me. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking the time out to have this chat. It's really lovely.
You're very welcome.
So what about me? Obviously, as my name kind of says, I'm not Irish. Irish soul, though. I moved to Ireland in May 2019, and it's a very interesting story as to how I came to be in Ireland. Mm-hmm. Would you like me to...
Oh, yes, please. Yes, please. I know you have a really interesting story to tell.
Okay. So back in 2016... Mm-hmm. I was invited by a dear friend of mine to come and visit her in Tralee. We knew each other because we used to work for the mm-hmm. same charity in the UK. My son was with his father over the Easter period, and I had a few days to myself. I was a single mom at the time, so I decided to take up my friend on her offer and flew into Tralee. It was the 2nd of April, 2016. Before then, I mean, I was living in mm-hmm. the UK at the time, and I was a humanitarian aid worker in my past life. So I'd had the...
What was the charity you were working for?
I worked for numerous different charities. I worked for the International Rescue Committee. Mm-hmm. I worked for a charity that was called Handicap International at the time. Mm-hmm. I did some work in partnership with the UN. So there were a number of different charities that...
So it must have been quite an experience.
It was really enjoyable. It was really enjoyable, and also, you know, a bit tiring and stressful at times because it was in the emergencies I was working in, and I was a child protection and protection specialist. So you kind of just mm-hmm. dropped into zones that require assistance.
Is there any one that particular sticks in your mind?
A particular sort of situation?
A particular event or situation that really sticks in your mind. You must have so many stories to tell.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess the biggest one was how I got started into humanitarian work. It was back in 2005. I had graduated from university in Canada, and I had moved back to Pakistan in 2004. Mm-hmm. And there was a big earthquake that hit Pakistan, Pakistan being where I'm from.
Yes.
In October 2005, I believe. I mean, I had studied psychology and philosophy at university. And obviously the whole nation kind of came together, and everybody desperately wanted to help because it was an earthquake of a really huge magnitude, and it caused widespread destruction. So I was recruited on the spot by a charity called World Vision. It's an international charity as well. And I remember the first trip I made, because we had to, all the roads had broken down. So a UN helicopter was taking people to the sites that were affected mostly to do an assessment and to see what sort of services could be provided. So, yeah, that was quite a profound learning experience.
Just in that short story, you mentioned that you'd grown up in Pakistan, or you've been at university in Canada, you're working in the UK, and now you're in Ireland. That's a really lot of experience. So many different stories, so many places. So which part of Pakistan did you grow up in?
Oh, the capital city, Islamabad, mostly, though I spent the first 10 years of my life in Karachi, which is another huge city in Pakistan.
So moving from there to Canada must have been quite a jump as well.
I'm a very adaptable individual.
That's clear. That's clear.
So it was a very, very brilliant experience. And, you know, we had traveled a fair bit. My dad loved travel. My mother hated mm-hmm. it. So it was really funny. Every time we used to go on a trip abroad, my sister and I and my dad would be perfectly happy. And my mum was like the child in the background going, "When can we go home?" I remember that clearly. She just still to this day doesn't really enjoy traveling. So yeah, it was a brilliant experience. I was in at York University, Toronto in Canada. And it was delightful. I really enjoyed it, but I do remember very interesting experiences at the beginning, because I mean, when I grew up in Pakistan, I went to a convent when I was small, so I would be bilingual from the very beginning of my life, so to speak. So people were very, very surprised. Some people were very surprised to hear me speaking in such good English. And I remember one student once asking me, so do you guys still live in mud houses in Pakistan? like some people do. You know, some parts are very rural, but no, we don't all live in mud houses. And yeah, I remember meeting people initially who were just kind of surprised. Like, so how long have you been in Canada for? 2 weeks? They'd be like, no, we don't believe that. You seem like you've been here forever. So it was just, I just tend to adapt to new situations quite quickly.
And what was your impression of Canada?
Oh, I adored it. It was really nice. It was incredibly multicultural. There was always something going on in Toronto. Everything from, you know, you had little Greece and little China and little Italy. There was always something going on. So I really made the most of my time there. So I spend enough time on academics, but I like to get out and about as well. And I had a very large circle of friends from all over the world. And yeah, really, really enjoyable horizon broadening experience.
And then you moved to the UK?
No, from Canada, this is quite funny. So I had gone from Pakistan to study in Canada. And then from Canada, I went to Australia on a further study abroad program.
Really? So where were you in Australia?
I was in Perth. At Curtin University in Perth.
Ah.
And I spent a year in Australia, which was also brilliant. Australia is another absolutely stunning country. Yeah.
It is, isn't it? I have very strong links, but not with Perth. I have links with Brisbane, the other side of the continent. And there's a very, very big difference between the West Coast and the East Coast. So I know the East Coast well, but not the West Coast.
Yeah, absolutely. I never got a chance to make it to the East Coast because I was a poor student at the time.
It's a long way.
It's a long way. It's a long way. It was the same with Canada. I never got a chance to make it to Vancouver on the other side because, again, it's a huge country and it's a long way.
So from Islamabad to Toronto to Perth, tell me more about your impressions of Western Australia.
It was really quite the nature, the wildlife, really warm people. Though I do believe that as a student, you'd be surrounded by other students. So whereas if I was working there, it probably would have been a very different experience. So as a student, you really get to experience the multicultural dimension and, you know, did a little bit of traveling on the west side as well, which was amazing. One of the things that really stands out to me was one of our professor. He was Indigenous Australian and he taught, I think it was called the Introduction to Indigenous Studies, something like that course. And he had an incredibly interesting story. And I think he was from the Noongar tribe. And he had been a policeman before he retrained to become a professor. So he used to tell us quite a lot of stories about being an Indigenous Australian in the police force. And what that was like.
Yes, he would have had a lot of stories,
and
I suspect.
Eventually how he got a bit tired of the dynamic because there was an undercurrent of profound racism that was going on.
Yes.
And that's why he decided to leave the police force and retrain as a teacher. And then he became a professor and he was excellent. He really was excellent. It's really funny how certain people really reshape the way you think and really stand out in your memory. Even after all these years.
I've been to Northwest Australia. And yes, having a chance to talk to people about the stories in the landscape and just having time to listen. There was one experience that I had in Australia that altered my perception of oral tradition storytelling. It was when I was up in Kakadu in the Northern Territories. I was taken to see some Indigenous art to be found in a rock shelter up in the hills, and my guide was describing the symbolism attached to some of the painted story characters and explained that these images were around 26,000 years old.
Yes.
But then he took a photo from a folder he had with him and showed it to me. And this, he said, is the man who painted it in 1968. Do you mean he repainted it? I asked. Oh, no, he painted them, he replied, and went on to identify other illustrated characters and creatures. Well, at that point, my Western-trained mind just went into a series of backflips. I mean, how could they be 26,000 years old and painted in 1968? Well, I had to think about it for quite a while before I got it. You see, if I go into a bookshop and buy a book of Shakespeare's plays, I don't then complain that they aren't the real thing because they come in a recently printed edition.
That is just beautiful.
That was just how I was approaching these stories. It did kind of change my outlook a bit.
And sometimes we don't accept it when it's told or recounted.
Absolutely.
Just being exposed to the whole notion of dream time.
Mm-hmm. The oral tradition.
And, yeah, the oral tradition and the dreaming in Australia. And then you kind of hold it in parallel with where there were so many hundreds of Indigenous languages and so many different tribes and cultural groups, how there was a very dark time through colonization, which still has its remnants. And that actually, what you were just saying about the ancient and the retelling of it, that actually links so beautifully to my arrival in Ireland. It's just beautiful how these conversations, they just loop and then link up.
Yes, that's why I just love sharing conversations. Well, we'll pick up on that when we're talking about some of the Irish stories, because I think my experiences in Northern Australia and Eastern Australia, again, taught me an awful lot about and helped me to understand and see Irish stories in a different way. But we'll come back to that in a minute. Go on, tell us, after coming from Islamabad, Canada, Australia, UK, you finally arrive in Ireland. So come on, I'm waiting to hear the rest of the story.
So, yeah, when I look back, it was so cute because I obviously had no notion. And all of this kind of came into perspective for me much later, quite a few months and years later. But at the time, you know, I accepted my friend's offer and I was like, oh, that's beautiful. I really feel like spending some time, you know, the countryside. And I didn't even know how to pronounce Tralee at the time. When I booked my ticket to fly there. So I remember landing at the beautiful little airport and I got off the plane and I just looked up at the sky and I had this immediate flooding of something inside of me. You know, when it's not a thought, but it arises from somewhere much deeper inside of you. And it was this feeling that I'm home. And after having lived in many different countries and having been raised in Pakistan and never having felt home anywhere at home, To feel that just kind of really shook me to the core. As I said, it was much later when I got back to the UK and I was processing my experience that all these other things started flooding back into my memory about how I had been kind of slightly obsessed and fascinated by anything from this part of the world when I was a teenager sitting in Pakistan. And I remember there was no internet then. The CDs were only just coming in. So we used to have cassette tapes and there was a shop in Islamabad where I used to go and buy my music from. I'm a big music fan. And I remember searching for anything that said Celtic on it.
Interesting.
And so Riverdance and, you know, the music of whatever I could find, really, in a country so far away.
It does kind of call, doesn't it? I know what you mean.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everything from U2 to the Cranberries, there was something. And I always had this real fascination with, you know, Celtic imagery. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, when I landed in Ireland, my friend didn't drive. So we rented a car at the airport and I was doing the driving. She's very organized. She had a whole itinerary planned and she was like, from here, we're going straight to Phoenix Beach. Okay. So within 2 hours of landing in Ireland, I was saying to her, I will have to move here. I had no idea how this was going to be possible, but it was just that it was something that had to be done. Interestingly enough, that night, my friend insisted that after being flying in, going to the beach, we went back for a meal at her house. She was like, and now we're going to the pub. And I was exhausted. after traveling all day. And I was like, can't we do this tomorrow, please? I'm really tired. She's like, no, you can't come to Ireland and not go to a pub. So off we went to a pub in Tralee. And ironically, that was the night that I also met my future partner.
You've got such a story. It's great.
Yeah, it was just mad because John is a percussionist. He was playing in the pub. There are some incredible, incredible musicians in Ireland in general. And I find Tralee is really blessed in terms of musicians. So, yeah.
That story, you couldn't tell a better story, could you? It's just... It just kind of fits together. It's almost too good to be true. And yet, you know, sometimes coming here just grabs people.
Yeah, it does. And since then, I've been so blessed to meet so many other people who feel the same way and who have been drawn here from all over.
I think it's just because Ireland is unique. It's independent, individual. But there's always something really old and yet current at the same time. Yes, I think it has something of the quality of the Irish stories. They can be down to earth with a great sense of humour. And at the same time, quite mysterious and unexpected. A foot in each of two worlds.
I think it, for me anyway, it's very much that otherworldly connection. And this is where it links to, you know, something being 20,000 years old and new at the same time.
I think
and
you're right.
I think... Yeah, I think a lot of people have energetic connections.
But before we leave the topic, just going back to the story I told about Australia, I was really interested to learn about the song lines of Australia in the Indigenous stories. But coming to Ireland, I always felt that what we've got here are storylines. The storylines link up the country with a whole network of connections that the stories still remember. Only here, they're known as Dinhyanaka stories, the lore of prominent place names. There's no way of telling how far they go back. They certainly don't go back 26,000 years. What we can say is that they were old when they were collected and collated together around 800 to 1,000 years ago. And Ireland is so lucky to be one of the few countries that have these stories that explain and interpret the landscape. I think it's one of the things that makes Ireland so special.
Yeah, it's really incredible.
We're very lucky, very lucky.
Incredibly, incredibly so. And this is one of the things that I really enjoyed, because after that, we obviously did end up relocating to Ireland, and it was in 2019. But there's something so magical about the land and the landscape. It is so available if you want to communicate with it.
Yeah, you can read the landscape. The stories are in the landscape.
Absolutely.
I agree with you. You're not in Kerry anymore, though, are you? I think you...
No, we're in County Clare. Which
so
is
you've
equally...
really been around. How do you like Clare?
I adore it. It's beautiful. I mean, there isn't a county that I have been to that I have not adored. Do you know what I mean? They're all so very special.
And there's stories in the landscape wherever you go. And you know, this has brought us to exactly where we want to be, which is talking about what's brought us together, which is some of the Irish mythological stories.
Absolutely, absolutely. And before we proceed with that, I'd just like to add something else. Now, this is another really funny story.
Go on.
My partner is called John Moriarty. And one of the first things that he did when he saw how kind of taken I was by Ireland, one of the first things he brought me was the philosopher and mystic John Moriarty. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading his book, Dreamtime, and it touched me deeply and profoundly. And he was such a scholar and a philosopher, a mystic and a poet, all in one. And unfortunately, his work isn't so well known, even in Ireland.
Now, the book you mentioned, Dreamtime, I think it was republished in 1994. And it's kind of relevant considering that we've been discussing First Nation Australian stories, is very well thought of. It's been described as the great book of transformations in a tapestry of themes and styles. and is well worth looking at. So I'll put a link to that and his other work up on the podcast website page.
Absolutely. It's just incredible, his body of work. And he was such a scholar of so many different mythologies. I was reading parts of his book, Invoking Ireland, over the past few days. And he can move from Greek into Norse, into Hindu cosmology, and back to Irish mythology. Do you know what I mean? And kind of weaving all of them together. And his entire notion of silver branch perception, you know, a very different way of seeing the world. And yeah, he lived at the base of Mangerton Mountain himself until he passed away.
So he certainly had a very strong influence on you.
Oh yes, absolutely. More so than influence, it was relatability. I mean, I instantly got it.
Yes, and it's always interesting to hear the different ways that people have been drawn to look at the stories in the landscape.
Absolutely.
Now let's look at some of the Irish stories. Are there any that you are especially drawn to?
I tend to just go with what my gut tells me, and then I'll pick up a story and do my research on it and see how it kind of settles with me. And one that I've been contemplating lately is the story of Bronn. Again, my pronunciation struggles sometimes. It's Bran Mac Fiol, is it?
I'm sure you're right. Isolde would always refer to him as Bran Mac Fiol, but she always used the old Irish form of the names. Do you know that's one of the oldest and earliest of the stories?
Oh, is it?
Bronn meets this mysterious and beautiful woman who has an apple branch with scented blossoms and which makes music and bells of silver. And it draws him to it so much that he has to follow the woman and takes the boat out to sea to find her and the apple branch. And he seeks for the Island of Women. Another world island, if ever there was one.
Yes.
Now, there's that silver apple branch again. You mentioned John Moriarty was talking about apple branch perception, I think it was. And the interesting thing is, there was an apple branch staff, which is described in several texts, including Brickru's Feast, as being at the court of King Concover, and again in the Toynbo Freoc at Cruachan. And it was a silver staff that was shaken to get everybody's attention so that the poet could speak. It meant stop and listen, something important is going on. It's a great story, because on the way, while he's on his wanderings, his Imrav across the sea, Mananaan comes to meet him in his boat, and he prophesies the birth of a child hero who is going to be both poet and ruler. And it's a very important prophecy, because this is about the now almost lost child Mongorn. But Shinscalella, that's another story.
I was reading John Moriarty's interpretations, that story in Invoking Ireland. And again, his interpretation is just something spectacular. And obviously that's where he gets his entire notion of the silver branch perception from.
The apple branch had a very important symbolic function, but it also had another worldly function. After all, one of the poet's main roles was to keep the way open between the worlds and to also ensure that the ruler followed natural law and listened to the words of his poet. Therefore, keeping the flow between the two worlds going, and thus the land green and growing.
Yeah, I mean, the aspects of that particular story that really stood out for me, and it's the way I hear the stories. They have such great depth and such meaning. I was looking at John Moriarty's interpretation and his kind of reimagining of the story, and the way he names the chapters as well. So one version is Ireland's Bhagavad Gita as a pagan might be happy to sing it. And the next chapter is Ireland's Bhagavad Gita as a Christian might be happy to sing it.
Yes. And that's exactly what the story is. Because for the monks who recorded and protected the story for the future, this hero saviour child is not only Mongorn, but is clearly the Christ child. And you can read the story both ways, as they seem to have done there.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many different ways of reading mythology. And what is so beautiful about mythology to me is the personal application and the relatability of it, and how certain things can stand out. And I was watching an interview with Joseph Campbell, and one of the things that he said in that kind of stuck with me was like, you know, a myth is a myth. It can be read on many different levels.
I think the thing about myths is they have applicability.
Yeah.
They're not historical. They don't have historicity. They have applicability. Yes, I suppose that's the particular ability of myth. They can speak to people in different voices and in different times in different ways. I suppose that's what gives myth such a power to inspire. For example, particularly in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, myth provided a much needed national narrative for countries struggling with colonial interference, like Finland or indeed Ireland. Mm-hmm. This inspirational effect has been generally benign, but it has to be said, not always. Now, at a different time, there are more and more people beginning to see their earlier, perhaps more ancient imperative, which was, if you don't protect the land, you will lose it. And I think this environmental message, which myths seem to also tell, is a valid reading.
Absolutely.
And this is why I think I love the story of Brum Fervil so much. It's a story that can be read in so many ways. There's a lot more about Mongorn, who eventually seems to hand on Dinhyanaka's knowledge to Columbkill himself. But as I said, Shinskelela, it's all on story archaeology. The other thing I like about Bron is that he doesn't make Oisin's mistake. He doesn't try to come back. He stays in the other world, but then comes back, stands in a boat off the shore, and hands on the stories.
Some of the things that immediately stood out to me when I came across the story, and then it was very, very interesting reading John Moriarty's reimagined version of it. What stuck out to me was because I'm from an Indian heritage, so to speak, Pakistani,
yes,
Indian, I personally don't differentiate. A lot of people might disagree with me on that one. And my grandparents were from India. So we all have the same genetic material. Do you know what I mean? And the countries were only separated in 1947, 1948. And when you look back at the history, you see how all of the different religions and cultural traditions in the Indian subcontinent have continually influenced each other over the past hundreds, if not, you know, much longer than that. So when I came to reading Irish mythology, there's a lot of stuff in the background, I suppose. There's another operating system that is working in the background. Mm-hmm. So when I look at these stories, I cannot help but look at them through a particular lens. And it was very, very beautiful and wonderful for me to come across writers and philosophers and thinkers like John Moriarty and Manckan Magan, who are also kind of looking at Irish mythology through a much, much wider, also the lens of spirituality, not religion, but spirituality. So in that sense, a lot of the myths are, as far as I'm concerned, and this is my personal view of it, it is about the journey back home to oneself and finding the core of oneself. So Bron's journey is one of, you know, hearing the silver branch sing, and he doesn't realize where the singing is coming from until he notices that it is the being itself of the silver branch that is singing. And that then forms a lot of John Moriarty's whole perception of silver branch thinking, which is why people also call him an eco-mystic, because he was wholeheartedly devoted to us appreciating the nature and the landscape that surrounds us, and to be in touch with its beingness, and that perhaps through being in touch with the beingness of nature, we would start to awaken to our own personal sense of being and our own sense of humanity. So there's that part. And I'll read you out a line from his book, which is so beautiful, which is when Abron meets Mananan, which is another very, very interesting parallel in terms of other mythologies from the subcontinent, because there's something that is always considered to be incredibly wise about the sea. So here we have Mananan, and in the subcontinental and even the Arabic and the Hebrew stories, you have Khizr, and he is known by many different names, who is also a sea god, but essentially they are both wisdom bringers, and they show up at times when their wisdom is required. So they wouldn't necessarily be central characters in a myth. However, their presence is very much felt. And I mean, Khizr, for example, is also spoken about in the Quran, in a surah in the Quran, where he advises Moses. So Khizr is like the seer of seers and the teacher of prophets, so to speak. And I very much got that feeling of Mananan as well. This is where I quote from the book. "Never are we so challenged in all that we are as we are when we encounter Mananan. The instant we meet him, we know that I and mind are habits of I and mind. The instant we meet him, we know that the world we have lived in was all along but a habit of seeing, a habit of knowing. The instant we meet him, we know that being human is a habit, and walking away, we know how shaken in that habit we now are. And how glad we are to be so shaken in this habit of being human, and shaken in it, at times shaken altogether out of it. To be human when being human is a habit we have broken, what that is a wonder."
That's a beautiful passage you just read to us. And yes, I think I understand what he means by silver branch perception. It symbolically represents the moment when we can perceive and are drawn to otherworld thinking, something that would have been completely understood by the early medieval and earlier pre-Norman poets. Oh, this is a topic that I think we really should return to in a further conversation. But for now, briefly, well, very briefly, you drew our attention to that overlay of stuff in some of the Irish stories. Yes, it's there. Christianity came early to the island, but it was different in kind originally to the heavier later blanket of Roman Christianity. The ancient stories, though, were still loved and protected in Ireland, even when recorded by Christian monks. Irish otherworld stories are wonderful, but the otherworld is ever-present, lying adjacent to our own. It can be reached unexpectedly by getting lost in a fog, a sudden fall of snow, finding a pool or an island in the middle of a river, you know, liminal spaces. This is the otherworld of imagination and memory, and it has governing rules. For instance, time works differently. Treasures may be found there, but it can be quite hard to bring them back to our mundane world of action. Yes, you're right, Moriarty really understands one of the deepest poetic skills, that willed change of perception. Perhaps what Gerard Manley Hopkins, who also spent much time in Ireland, referred to as inscape. Oh, there's so much more I'd love to discuss with you, but for now, I'll just add one more relevant comment. As Christianity prevailed, the imminent other world could be a bit troubling to those following a more eschatological path. And the route to the other world kind of moved off land to islands, and the mythological guardian who maintained the border balance, Mither, transformed to Mananan of the sea. Yes, and they are both figures who offer wisdom and guidance. So the apple branch became the most familiar call to perception.
Yeah, it was just one that deeply touched me. So it's literally, when I read the story, for me it is... literally Bron's journey of following himself. You know, it's we arrive home, but the home that we arrive in, even though we have done a full circle, it's a different world.
I think you're absolutely right. And that perhaps once you've had the opportunity to change your perception, you never quite perceive the world the same way again.
Absolutely. And then, you know, when the other thing that really stands out about this is the guidance from what I perceive to be the divine feminine, you know, the invitation into a completely different way of seeing.
Yes, it's true. In so many Irish stories, these messengers from the other world, they're generally women, occasionally in the form of white birds. Sometimes they have their own names, like Fand, or they may have titles, like Beavis.
Absolutely. So it is a really incredible, deep story. So that different way of seeing has been opened up to him, and this different way of perceiving, this divine seeing, which, again, has great links into all sorts of other mythologies as well.
Yes, it's an Imhoff, an unplanned journey that you allow to take you to the other. So when you first contacted me, Sana, you were, it seems, interested in the story of Shinnan and her connection to the Shannon. So where did you first come across Shinnan, and why were you attracted to her story?
Oh, this is really exciting and so much fun. Obviously, we live in Clare, and we're in Newmarket on Fergus, which is very, very close to Shannon. And we will be relocating house shortly. And the next place that we have found to move to actually overlooks the Shannon. Like, you can see the Shannon. It's in O'Brien's Bridge from the front windows of the house. When we went to visit the house, it just completely took my breath away. It was just so incredibly majestic and spectacular. So I was sitting at home one day and I was like, well, everything has an origin story. And I'm going to look up the story behind the Shannon. And when I started looking at it, one of the first articles that I came across was, I believe, one that you wrote in, I think it was the Irish Independent. And it was just so beautifully written. And it was about mythology and its applicability to our lives. And it spoke about your love of the story of Shannon. And it very kindly contained a link to your website, which I then visited to read more about this. And I listened to your podcast, and I was completing, because one of the beauty of the way you do things on your website is, you know, you have the podcast and then you have several links so that, you yes. know, people can really engage, and depending on their level of curiosity. So I was going through it bit by bit, and then I came to the paper. And when I clicked on the link for the paper, it just would not open for me. And I really wanted to read the paper. So thankfully, your email was there. And I sent you an email saying, oh, could you please advise me? Because I'd like to read the paper. Where can I access it?
Yeah.
And you very kindly responded immediately and told me about it. And I exchanged some thoughts after reading the paper as well, I believe. And after listening to your story of Shannon, I was very inspired by it. So I shared some of my thoughts, and that's how we got talking.
Funny enough, I'm not sure which article it was that you saw. It was probably connected with one of the projects I was working on with Ralph Kenner at the time. But I'm just delighted that yes. the story of Shannon, in the form it was originally recorded in the Dinn Hialicus, is now so well known.
Yes.
When I went searching for the origin story of the Shannon, back in 1990 that was, all I could find then was a kind of mashup story, effectively made up by a well-meaning scholar, Eugene O'Curry, in the mid-19th century. He described Shannon as a disobedient woman who dared to go near a well, safe if approached by men only. As you mentioned, Sana, you can find a journey of the story's restoration as well as all of his oldest translations on storyarchaeology.com. So I won't say any more here, but I will add links to the website page for this episode. Actually, something else I've thought of. Shinnan's described as a poet, the noblest of her people, and she seeks for poetic inspiration which will keep the way to the other world open. You talked about John Moriarty's Silver Branch journey. Her journey is equally a journey of Silver Branch perception. Just like Bran's, except maybe as a poet, she does have the right to take this risky journey. Maybe that's why there's no Silver Branch or Apple Branch inviting her to embark on the journey. She succeeds, is absorbed into the river. Well, she is the river. The perception shift is made.
Yes, I would absolutely agree with that. And again, the parallels of the story. I mean, the original portrays Shinnan as, you know, a very pure, knowledgeable, but retaining that innocence, who would like to find that inspiration, that poetic inspiration, and not just inspiration, but to be able to convey that inspiration as well. And again, it's in the story, there's the number, as I see it, 9 appears again. There are 9 hazel trees lining the well, and in one version.
Yes, I know you mentioned, and quite rightly, how significant a number 9 is in so many mythologies.
But again, the significance of the hazel tree, the significance of the salmon eating the nuts of the tree. And then it was almost, you know, as if the desire to spread that poetic inspiration, you know, the well water kind of rises to meet her. And in one sense, it's, you know, she merges with it.
Oh, yes, I think she definitely does merge with the river. As I said, I think she is the river. But it's very interesting. Whereas Bronn met Manannan, the wisdom guide, so Shinnan interacts with the salmon, which is always a symbol of wisdom, and the nuts, which contain the whole world in a nutshell. And come to think of it, if archaeologists go back as far as Mesolithic times, they often find remnants of the foods that were eaten by the people of that time and the staples of their diet, were in fact hazelnuts and salmon. They may be expensive today, but back then they were the stuff of life, so probably quite good symbols of wisdom. Back in the time of the stories, the poets were sometimes called seers, but I suppose that's a good name because they could sometimes see what other people didn't notice.
Yes, a vision maker or somebody who can just, I mean, I firmly believe that that vision is inside us all. So it takes us back to the sense of embracing the sense of beingness and to be able to penetrate that clarity and that insight that lies within all of us, but is not usually accessible due to the layers and layers of conditioning, societal, cultural, geographical, whatever you want to call it, but to actually be able to penetrate all of that and then bring forth the jewels through poetry.
So I suppose we could say that Shinnan's Silver Branch perception journey is indeed quite transformational.
I find in my personal journey, it has been very helpful to share stories with a personal light shed on them, because as I said before, it kind of opens the door for other people to look at them in a way that it's almost like sometimes on our personal journeys, we need permission that, okay, if this person can do it, oh, so can I. So where does this reverberate? How does this resonate with me? So in that sense, it's like for me, Shinnan really kind of deeply touched my heart, because it was in so many ways this act of incredible bravery and this desire. I mean, I'm a very, you know, knowledge hungry person myself, you know, this massive desire for knowledge, this desire for sharing, that for me is so deeply connected to the divine feminine and the feminine body, and the female body in particular. You know, as we give birth, we share off our bodies. And then it's just the fervor and the earnestness and the desire that actually makes the well rise up. And then it turns into this huge river of wisdom that is freely available to everybody. And the salmon that were in the well previously are set free in the river.
Well, yes, I think what you're describing is transformational. This conversation has covered such a lot of ground today. You've shared memories of your home in Islamabad, Canada, and the UK, as well as Australia. We've also been able to explore 2 of our personal favourite stories from Irish mythology. We've looked at them as teaching stories, like the stories of Australia, handed down, passed on in a form that could easily be remembered. And I think Irish stories have that quality as well. But we've also looked at their applicability and how they can work for a whole people a whole country, but also for individuals.
This is where, like I said, I'm more interested in looking at the personal applicability of myths. For example, like if I am able to share what has touched me about a myth, I'm no scholar, I'm no historian, then perhaps to somebody else, they will be able to open up to a story and take what they need for them from it.
Thank you so much, Sana, and such a wonderful Stories in a Landscape conversation. Well, thank you, and I hope you'll come back and we'll have another conversation, because I'm sure we've got
more to share.
It
was an absolute pleasure. It's always a pleasure speaking with you, and I learned so much. And it's lovely to be able to share and bring two different perspectives together in one sense. It's really enjoyable. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sana. Thank you for listening to this Stories in the Landscape conversation. Remember, on www.storyarchaeology.com, you will be able to access the whole archive of Story Archaeology podcasts. You can also explore a wide selection of my audio and video stories for children, as well as a range of project and support materials for schools. Also, discover information on a number of international arts events and competitions with which Story Archaeology is closely linked. There will be another Stories in the Landscape conversation along soon.